Well, good morning. It's good to be with you again. I don't remember the last time, but the last time we started a little bit of a study on Romans 13, so if you want to turn to it. And just by way of introduction, don't want to get into politics, but I noticed it was mentioned at the very beginning of the Sunday school hour, the deplorable political situation we find ourselves in. And as we, as believers, have to face the culture in which we live in, we have to deal with the political situation. And as time goes on, it looks like we will lose more and more of our freedoms. So Romans chapter 13 is a timely and, I think, essential passage to understand. And it's very fundamental. In fact, one of the fundamental principles of all of the Bible is the concept of submission. And last time I was here, I gave you a little bit of a introduction and a little bit of the background to Romans 13. So I'll give you a quick review on that and then move one step a little bit further. And if you have an outline sheet, focus on the reasons why we as believers need to be submissive. Now, I think the concept is broad, not only in the book of Romans, but biblically, in that there's different areas that we are called upon to be submissive, particularly within the home, but also within the society. So this is a biblical concept. In fact, I think it's a concept that is essential that you teach your children, and many of you have grandchildren, pass it on to them as well. And we'll get along better, not only in the culture, but also in terms of our relationship to the Lord. So let me give you a little bit of a reminder. And like I said, we're going to stress the reasons that are contained in this passage for submission. And on your outline sheet, I've got them numbered. I've got an outline within an outline. So the outline is of the passage itself. Biblically, it's called an exegetical outline that tries to draw out the main thought and the flow of the ideas and how it's structured. And then the outline within is more applicational, the reasons for submission. So obviously, we're talking about a group of believers that Paul is writing to in the first century. And if you visit Rome today, you'll visit the Roman Forum representing first century Rome and what Christians would have been familiar with, and they had to deal with the government. This was the center of all activity, both cultural as well as governmental. So, well-known site, Roman Forum, right in the same location, these monuments to all kinds of past events. And I just use that slide as a little bit of a background to review what we did last time. I gave you the textual context. It's always important to understand where any given passage fits within the broader perspective of either a book or the broader context, the Bible in itself. So we looked at the textual context, and let me just remind you, the book of Romans, you can divide it into three major divisions. Now, I will include the introduction in the first division, first eight chapters, even though it's a long introduction. You can put it within that. Where this is the heart of the book of Romans, where Paul is explaining that God has provided the concept of righteousness. In fact, that's the key word of the whole book. It occurs, I think, 66 times. So you have to understand what that means. A right standing before something. And in Romans, particularly a right standing before God. And it's God's own nature, his own attribute of righteousness that we enter into a relationship with. And God has provided righteousness for the believer. This is the concept of salvation. We commonly refer to it the concept of soteriology, the whole doctrine. In fact, many sub-doctrines contained in that passage. So first eight chapters. And then the issue in the first century, well, I thought God's people were the Jewish people. I thought they were the ones that God had called to himself, and he was the one that was working through them. What about them? How do they fit in? Are they rejected? Has the church replaced Israel? And I think chapters 9 through 11, we didn't touch on that, but if we did, the thing that I would emphasize is that the concept of replacement theology, I don't know if you've heard about it, some denominations hold to it. In fact, it's relatively common in the broader Christian church, but I think it's a heresy. I think it is a very damaging doctrine. And Romans 9 through 11 go contrary. In other words, this is the central passage that argues against that concept and says, yes, God has temporarily set aside the nation of Israel, but they do have a future. They're under discipline until a time of the Gentiles is completed. We're living in that time frame. And then when that is completed, then God is going to bring Israel into a relationship. And Paul makes a statement in chapter 11, all Israel shall be saved. So the church does not replace Israel. In fact, I believe and I teach that world history is Jewish. And we're just in a period of time where God is reaching out to Gentiles on the same basis. But even the church age is composed of what? Both Jew and Gentile. So Israel is not set aside totally or permanently, but only in a temporary period of discipline. The third major division, so in that passage, Paul is vindicating the righteousness of God. He is perfectly righteous in setting aside his people, the nation of Israel, or the people of Israel. And it's temporary, but God is also righteous in that he's going to fulfill all of the promises and all of the covenants that he's entered into. And those will come together after a period of time devoted somewhat to Gentiles. So that's the second major division. The third major division is how do all of these principles come together and what should they look like as we live out the Christian life? So how do these principles of soteriology, these principles of salvation, how do they work themselves out in these different categories? First of all, first two verses, chapter 12, what does the Christian life look like? And it's a life of giving up your own life, basically. As a living and holy sacrifice, you seek God's will day by day, moment by moment. So that's the heart of Christianity. 12, 1, and 2. And then we looked, in fact, I touched on both of those in prior, one of them, the first one, I don't know, a couple of years ago, I guess. The chapter 12, beginning of verse 3 through the end, what does Christianity look like when it's worked out within the body of Christ, within the church? Two main emphases. We emphasize the first one. It's the ministry of the church through the spiritual gifts that God has given to each one of us. So that's what it looks like. How does the Christian life look within the body of Christ? All of us should have a ministry. All of us should be ministering to one another. We have that relationship and are empowered to do that through spiritual gifts. So we spent some time looking at it. The second part is pretty obvious. I didn't touch on it because it's pretty common teaching and I think very familiar to most believers. Love, and the next part deals with the issue of loving one another. And then in chapter 13, where we're going to focus our time this morning, what does Christianity look like when it's lived out within the culture? And the fundamental and the basic principle is the principle of submission, to primarily authority. But the principle is broader, as I've already said, so it applies to other areas as well. Then there's another portion of the practical portion or the applicational portion where Paul is applying these principles of righteousness to the Christian life and particularly an issue in Rome and the first century, the issue of Christian liberty. So that's chapters 14 through about the middle of chapter 15. Then there's a long conclusion. So that's the whole book on one slide there. on outline form, that's chart form, outline form, we're looking at the application of God's righteousness, application to God, I mentioned, application to the church, and now we're looking at application to the society or the culture. And that's all of chapter 13. You can break it down, and we're not going to look at all seven verses. I gave you kind of an overview of the first two verses. I'm going to review that again, and then we'll move on and pull out some applications that we can apply that give us reasons why it's very important that we apply moment by moment, day by day, the concept of submission. So you can break even first seven verses down of chapter 13. We have the foundation, and that's what we devoted our time. When was it? 4 months ago? I don't remember. Lose track of time. I always look forward, not backwards. So we looked at verse 1, a response of submissiveness. In other words, this is the essence and the heart of what verse 1 is encouraging. And it's the foundation to everything else he's going to talk about. He's going to develop that in further detail. And it talks about every person. Now, in this context, it's primarily applicable to believers. But this is a broad concept. It's a concept that involves all of humanity. In fact, it's a fundamental concept of all of mankind. God has created creatures. And by virtue of creation and as creator, he calls upon all creatures to be submissive. And we stressed the importance of that last time. And the context, so that's the textual context. So that's where this passage fits in the broader picture of the book of Romans. And then you can look at a historical context. And I gave you an overview last time. I won't get into all the detail. Of the Roman Empire, that's what RE stands for there on the slide there. What was the Roman Empire like? And this is to encourage us because we are getting very much closer and closer to some of the conditions that the Romans were under a Roman system. There are a lot of good things, but there are also some negatives in terms of not only Christianity, but in the first century Judaism. So we looked at the Roman Empire. Gave you a little background on the Roman government, what it was like. They had governments a little bit similar to ours. In fact, ours, I think, is patterned after the Roman and the Greek systems in that they had a divided government. They had a Senate. In other words, all the power didn't reside into one person. But slowly, that devolved into more of a centralized totalitarian system. And that's the situation when Paul is writing. And the treatment dealing with the Jews, this is important because we had a broader audience in the Roman church. In fact, there are many smaller churches that are addressed in the book of Romans. Some of them smaller than the gathering here. Some of them were house churches. And there was the issue of how did the Romans treat the Jews? They essentially tolerated them. And they made some exceptions in terms of how they treated the Jewish people. They were tolerant of their religion and their culture. They gave them some freedom, more so than some other peoples that were subject to the Roman Empire. They permitted Sabbath worship, for example. And in others, they demanded sometimes, the worship of the, by this time, the worship of the emperor. Now, they tolerated the Jews not doing that. They permitted the Jews to not have images in their temple, which was a big concession in the Roman Empire. They didn't require them to worship the emperor. That would have caused quite a bit of rebellion, even more rebellion that existed already. And the Jewish people were somewhat rebellious, even under somewhat lenient treatment in comparison to other peoples. And by 49 and 53, the Jews were expelled from Rome. So this is a little bit of the background and the historical setting of this passage. And this is the situation that the Romans were under, particularly the Roman believers. So Paul is writing here to make sure that the church doesn't make the same mistakes that Israel was making, because Israel was not submissive to the Roman Empire. They were submissive to the least extent that they could get away with. So that's what he's writing about, and the Jewish attitude reflected that. They stressed nationalism, and in fact they resented the concept that they were under a Roman rule or a Gentile power over them was resented, and they emphasized nationalism, depending on some passages like Deuteronomy 17 that talks about Jewish kings. And you see that reflected in Jesus' interaction with some of the leaders in John 8:33. We looked at that passage. They stressed their rights and their independence. And they were in constant rebellion, and some of that is reflected in the book of Acts as well, rebellion to the Roman Empire. And there were zealots, in fact, a whole political party or movement of individuals that even promoted the idea of military rebellion from the Roman Empire. And as a result, they were expelled from Rome. In other words, Rome had only a certain amount of patience with them and then began to take action. And then you know what happened in 70 AD, and then the rebellion was completed later on, 136 AD, where Jews were expelled from Israel, nation destroyed, temple destroyed, etc. And that's pictured in some of the artwork of even more recent times. Temple destroyed, city destroyed, nation destroyed, Jews scattered. And now this was before Paul writes the book of Romans, but he could see that this is where things were leading and did end in that way. And what Paul is concerned about, so this is the historical background. This is a historical context. He doesn't want the church to make the same mistake, because Judaism was violating a fundamental principle of Scripture. So this is what Paul is bringing out in Romans chapter 13, the principle of submission to authority. So that's your background. Theologically, we looked at the importance. I won't stress this. But even within the Trinity, this is a concept that even within the Trinity, there are levels of authority, you might say, or positions within the Trinity, and that's brought out in 1 Corinthians 15:27, even 1 Corinthians 11 and other passages. The ultimate authority is God himself, God the Father, Psalm 62:11. The fall of Satan was rebellion against that authority. That's the essence of the rebellion. It denied or undermined the authority of God himself. Fall of man follows. In other words, following the will of Satan, the woman, rather than the will of God, that has been made clear. Rebellion against the authority and the word that came from that authority. You can see it and you can trace it. I just have one example here. You can trace it throughout Scripture. Rebellion after rebellion. Cain resisted the authority. God confronts him directly and he resists that. Genesis 4 and on. You see it at Babel, and you can trace it throughout biblical history. And it peaks and ultimately will be manifested in Antichrist even in the future. So this is a very important concept that Paul is bringing to us. So you might say theologically, this is the broader context of the concept of authority. So every person, as we said, broadly, this is the way God has created and set up a universe such that he is the ultimate authority and all creatures, all things are subject to him. He is sovereign over them and he is the ultimate authority. So every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities. Broad statement, very simple. I mean, it's not hard to understand, and we talked a little bit about that last time. Not a difficult concept, but it's sometimes difficult to apply, particularly if you're living under a system that goes contrary to your worldview and your belief system, and sometimes demands things that you think are not what God would have you to do. And we may be getting closer to that point, so we'll talk a little bit about that. So every person is to be in submission. We define what submission is, the term hupotasso, the Greek word there. It's a military term where you have ranking, if you will. You have authority, and then you have lesser authority, and you have lesser authority even to that. So it's a military term. To line up under is the idea. In other words, you put yourself under the authority. To rank one, in other words, you view yourself as within a certain system, a military system, you might even say, or a spiritual system that God has set up. And the idea just to submit to authority. In other words, what the authority says, this is what I comply with, and this is how I organize my affairs and my life. So it begins with submission to God. And He's the ultimate authority, and if your submission is not what it should be in terms of God, then it's going to filter down to all of the lesser authorities that you will be a part of, the culture, within the family, etc. So it begins with a submission to the authority of God Himself. And it's an attitude. It includes an attitude of the heart. It's not mechanical. It's not a legalistic approach, but one that stems from a submitting first to God. And because we submit to Him, and this is the concept and the system He has set up, now I'm able to submit to all of the other authorities below God as well. So it's at the heart of the Christian life. It's at everyday issues that we face every day. You drive your car, you're under the authority of the laws that deal with cars, right? Go to a school, they have certain rules, they have certain standards. You have to, as a student, you have to submit to that authority, the government, etc. So we have, God has set up all of these, and in some cases, institutions that are from Him, and one of them is government itself. So a very important concept. So verse 1 deals with a response of submissiveness, and then it describes the ruler of authority, who is God Himself. For there is no authority except from God. So all authority in this whole system is from God. This is the way He set it up. And if He's the one that set it up this way, then that's the main reason why we submit to authority. So all authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. So no distinctions. That was the point of the historical background. Whether you're under a monarchy, whether you're in an aristocratic system, or a republic, which we are supposed to be. We have drifted somewhat from a republic. Or a broader, the democratic system. Or you could include totalitarian, which the Roman Empire was moving more and more to centralized power at the time that the Book of Romans was written. So totalitarian, if you're under a totalitarian, it doesn't make a distinction in Romans 13. This is the broad principle. Whether it's atheistic or even if it's evil. Even if it's evil. Paul is not saying, well, if it's evil, then you're not under this standard. It's very broad. Leaders fulfilling the God-given purpose of government or not. No distinction. An example Peter gives of a wife that is under the authority of an unbelieving husband. And he gives guidelines there, and basically he's supporting the concept of submission. Now, there are some exceptions, and as usual, I may not have enough time to get there. If you've been with me before, most of you have, You remember I only get through usually half of what I intend to get through, so we'll see how far we get. So what are some of the reasons? Well, from verse 1 and verse 2, you might say that even from creation, just the nature of how God has set up his universe gives us a reason. This is the way things are. God has built a system of authority with him at the top, and he's instituted institutions, government being one of them, the family being another one. You might even say things like schools and employer-employee relationships. There's the systems of authority. So by nature, because of the way God has set things up, this is the starting point. This is the way God has created a universe. So that's verse 1. And also verse 1, those which exist are established by God. And that's another huge and major reason, so we can add to our list here. So number 2 on your outline sheet would be by divine decree. This is what God has set up. This is the way God has instituted the universe. And he has decreed and instructed in passages like Romans 13:1. And commanded, in fact, it's an imperative. So by decree, this is what God has set up. So when we are violating it, we are going not only against the way God has set things up, but we're going against what God has clearly mandated and what God has decreed. So two very important reasons for submission. And not only to government, but you can apply these to all of the realms in which submission is called upon and systems that God has established. So verse 2 gets into more specific reasons. These are kind of broad-based from verse 1. So reasons for submission, verse 2 in my outline. Therefore, now he's going to argue now. Therefore, whoever resists authority. So the one that goes against the way God has set things up, the one who goes against God's clear command or his decree or his will, you might say, whoever resists authority, has opposed the ordinances of God. Now let's take a look at the word resists. Now, you already saw, in fact, I'll repeat it here, the word for submission, and notice the spelling there, hupotasso. I've got it transliterated in English letters there. That's submission, hupotasso. Notice the last part of the word there. The meaning, to submit to authority, but now we have another word, the word resist. Notice the similarity. It's the very opposite. You see the similarity word? Antitasso. Anti is what? Something that goes against, whatever the latter part is. So it has that same kind of root idea of submitting, like hupotasso. In other words, put yourself under authority. Hupo, under. Anti, resisting, is going against. And that's the idea there. So the words are, in fact, related and part of the broader word group, you might say. So it's to resist and to oppose. So opposition. So you need to be very careful when you carry a sign in the streets. Not that that is not permitted. I think under our system it is. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed, very strong, has opposed the ordinance of God, or the decree, or the law, or the mandate. Bottom line, the will of God. So opposing authority is opposing essentially what God has established. So another reason from verse 2, resistance is rebellion. So resisting, very strong word, is rebellion against God, ultimately. In fact, he's going to develop this all the way through verse 4, so this will be expanded upon as you read through the biblical text. Then he says, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. Condemnation, because this is rebellion, and rebellion must be dealt with. A holy God must deal with rebellion. So the receiving of condemnation upon themselves. In other words, you have brought this on yourself if you're resisting authority. So this is very strong language. Not easy to comply with, especially when the authorities are not in line with your thinking or your worldview or sympathetic to what you believe. And this is the case whether you're in a marriage to an unbeliever that doesn't believe in Christ, or whether you are a student in a school that is teaching things that probably shouldn't be taught, or an employer that perhaps is an evil man. So this is very applicable and touches us in terms of the broader culture as well. So verses 3 through 5 in my outline here, 1 and 2, the foundation, and the foundation is basically the mandate or the command or the instruction. And now he's going to get into the functioning of the state, more specifically, the specific authority of government. And what is the function of the state there, state's function? Sometimes I try to alliterate, so you see the submission foundation, and then you see the state's function. We have the ruler's ministry that we started to look at in verse 3, 3 and 4. For rulers are not a cause of good behavior. And now he's essentially going to lay out the responsibilities from God's perspective of government. Not that government always complies. In fact, most of the time it does not. But this is God's intent in establishing a system of authority that is broad, governmental, and he's talking about rulers. Now, it filters down to all the other categories you might name as well, but rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior. So here's the alternative. Rather than resisting, if we comply, we don't have to be fearful, because rulers, part of their reason for ruling is they should reward, you might say, good behavior. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior. So when we comply, we can be at ease. We don't have to be concerned. But for evil, and I think that lays out one of the fundamental purposes that God has established. Now keep in mind, this is from God's perspective. From God's perspective, he has established government for the purpose of dealing with evil. Not for good, necessarily, but for evil. Do you want to have, he's expanding here, do you want to have no fear of authority? Now, authority is fearful, especially if the authority is evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? In other words, you want to live in peace, you want to not be concerned as you go out into the culture. That gives us the first role of government. Now, this is from God's perspective. Now, if government doesn't fulfill what God has intended for it, we trust in a sovereign God who is sovereign and the ultimate authority. He can change that. He can raise up a new government. He can take down an evil government, and you have examples of that throughout history as well. But oftentimes this does not happen within a lifetime, and sometimes it doesn't happen at all in some situations. But the main purpose for government is to restrain evil. So when you have a corrupt government that is the author of evil, then you are in a very difficult situation as a believer. But one of the purposes that God has established government is to restrain evil. And that's part of the reason for nations, different governments, to serve as a check upon one another in terms of restraining the broader evil in the world. And you have examples from the nation of Israel in the Old Testament. You have punishment for the nation of Israel. God set up the nation of Israel and, in fact, created it, called one man out of the nations, Abraham, made promises and covenants. And within that, the law specifies punishment for evildoers, intended to restrain evil. And the law also teaches what is right and what is wrong, and particularly from God's perspective, teaching right and wrong. And in that, it restrains evil. If the citizens know what is right and there's punishment for what is wrong, then that has a tendency of restraining evil. So good laws, good government, acting biblically, you might say, restrains evil. So it deters crime, and there's a means of dealing with crime. And in fact, the law is obviously inspired and from God, and you know one of the elements of it is it's designed for rehabilitation as well. And there's a lot of provisions in the law, we don't have time to get into the details, that provide for restoration and rehabilitation of those that, in fact, have fallen by the wayside in terms of the law. And it's to prevent vengeance as well. In fact, entire cities were set up, cities where lawbreakers could reside to avoid perhaps family vengeance that might get out of hand as well. So the Old Testament gives us a model of government, and the law specifies certain things for the nation of Israel. Not that Israel complied, but this is what God intended. And it gives us a perspective on God's purpose for government. Let me ask you a question. Did Israel, in the law, provide prisons? I don't see a yes, so maybe that's the consensus. So let's take that one. No prisons in Israel. Interestingly, almost all of the other cultures had prisons. Lots of examples. In Egypt, remember Joseph was in prison. The Philistines, Samson was in prison, Judges 16:21. Assyria, Hoshea, 2 Kings 17:4, was put in prison. Now this is at the end of Israel's history. Babylon, Jehoiakim, 2 Kings 25:27, was thrown in prison, which indicates all of these cultures had a means of confining those that they deemed as evildoers or those that violated their standards. The Romans, John, Peter, Paul, Silas, were all thrown in prisons or jails. In fact, some of them dungeons. When we were in Israel, we visited a dungeon, and there's a difference between a dungeon. Do you remember the difference between a dungeon and a prison? A dungeon was a place where nothing was provided and you could starve to death or be eaten by rats or whatever. A prison was a more humane place to confine evildoers until they had a trial. But dungeons were a horrific place, and we visited one and saw a little bit of the evidence of what they were like. But the point being, no prisons in Israel. Crime was dealt with, and evildoers were punished. Or, if they were innocent, they were acquitted, and there was a system of determining whether one was guilty and or innocent. Anyway, that's one of the reasons and one of the purposes of human government from God's perspective. So another reason, the danger of punishment. So if you're in violation, government can, in fact, punish. And you want to avoid that, and that's the encouragement of those verses. And then the verse goes on, do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. So the reward, if you will, that government gives is it can praise you Not all governments do that, but if you don't hear from government, that's a praise, right? That's a positive. So do what is good. So the encouragement, another command, another encouragement, and you will have, this is kind of a reasoning here, a reason, you'll have praise from the same, or at least be left alone. So another reason is blessings. And you can see from God, God can bless you as you are obedient to government authority. So blessings for obedience, you can add that to a list of reasons why we can be submissive or should be submissive, verses 3 and 4. And then here's an interesting verse here, verse 4. For it is a minister of God to you for good. A minister? Do government officials go to seminary? Do they get theological training? That's the same word. It's a common word for those that minister the Word of God, those that teach the Bible. It's the same identical word. From God's perspective, He has put even unbelieving rulers in a position to accomplish some of God's goals, to accomplish some of what God desires a government to accomplish. And in that sense, they are ministering to God. In fact, in some systems, they call their officials ministers. In other words, the ministry of such and such. For it is a minister of God to you for good. And notice it's used two times, not only at the beginning of verse 4, for it is a minister of God to you for good, then later on in the verse, after the semicolon, for it is a minister of God, same word, minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. So God is accomplishing certain things through even the most vile, even the most evil, even the most corrupt government officials, because He is sovereign over them. And knowing that He is sovereign and we are under Him as the ultimate authority, we can find peace in living even the most corrupt governments. So they are accomplishing certain things, and God could intervene at any point and remove an official or remove even an entire government or even an entire nation. So the role of government, restrain evil, reward of good, and the word minister, diakonos, you seen that word? How is that translated in other places? Servant. Servant or minister. 12:7, if you just go back just a chapter, verse 7, it's a spiritual gift, gift of service. In fact, it's the same word that's used for deacons. A specific kind of a minister, one that serves. So a government official is a servant of God. He's like a deacon. He may be evil, he may be corrupt, but God can use him to accomplish His purposes. And sometimes it's to drive us to our knees when we're the victims of evil government. So, another reason that we submit, verse 4, fulfills God's overall broader ministry. So, God has a work that He is working in a culture, and He uses the divine institution that He instituted to accomplish His, and we can call it a ministry, so He can accomplish it. Sometimes it's hard to see. Sometimes it's, you know, we're celebrating the anniversary of the reversal of Roe versus Wade. And for 49 years, that was an evil that plagued our country. And through those 50 years, you scratch your head. How is this accomplishing anything that God has in mind? Well, we're looking at kind of the isolated situation, but the bigger picture is God is still using even that evil to accomplish good. And there's some things that we could see came out of it as well. So it fulfills God's ministry. Very strong reason why we need to be submissive. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, reinforcing what he's already said. For it does not bear the sword for nothing. Now, the law is very clear. In fact, there are several specific crimes that are capital crimes. In other words, capital punishment. And some might argue within the church, well, there's no capital punishment in the church, is there? Well, this verse seems to indicate the opposite. In other words, the sword here is the execution sword. In other words, capital punishment. So I think the principle is carried over in the New Testament primarily from this verse, and there's other verses as well. And it's talking about it, the government. It does not bear, or the ruler, or the minister of God, the governmental minister, it does not bear the sword for nothing. In other words, it has the capacity and the even mandate to deal out punishment, the ultimate punishment of the sword. For, and there it is again, it is a minister. In other words, it's accomplishing certain things. One of the things, it's restraining evil. And you say, well, it's not a deterrent. Well, I think it is a deterrent, but even if you make that argument, it at least deters the crime of that one criminal. An avenger who brings wrath, the wrath of God. So it's executing justice, God's justice. Part of God's justice is the expressing of wrath on the one who practices the evil. So some of the roles of government: restrain evil, rewarding good, retribution of evil. In other words, the role of government is to punish, and it can go to the ultimate capital punishment. The sword, makaria, that's the executioner's sword, used commonly. It was also used in the military. But do a word study on that in the New Testament. The instrument of execution, capital punishment. And based on the Old Testament, here's just one example, Deuteronomy 21, but that, like I said, there are several crimes. In fact, I think I use that 21 because I think that passage, I'll have to go back and look it up, but I think that's juvenile delinquents, capital crime. Of course, you as parents can't. You need to go to the governing authorities. So, verse 5, the final reason I have on my list here, the reason of conscience. The reason of conscience. Therefore, it is necessary to be in subjection. See, he's talking about the same thing. This whole passage is dealing with subjection to authority, and I think it deals with it broadly, giving a specific example of government in the middle, but broadly, for not only because of wrath, in other words, not only because government may deal with you or deal with the crime, but also for conscience' sake. It affects our relationship to God. So not being submissive means that it's going to get you out of fellowship. I mean, it's one of the things that prevents you from having intimacy and having a relationship. And you have to confess that as sin, because that's what the passage is teaching. So for conscience' sake, for staying in fellowship. Staying connected, staying in that relationship with God where he's guiding you, you're walking with him, you're in fellowship with him, he's communicating with you. That can be broken as a believer. And when that's broken for whatever reason, whether it be unsubmissiveness or other reasons, 1 John 1:9 needs to be applied. Well, our time is up, and we don't have time to look at some exceptions, but very quickly, we have lots of examples of exceptions, and the particular exceptions, you can draw some principles from them. So there are some situations where we say no to the government. They are very rare, and in our culture, I would say very, very rare. So in general, 99.99% of the time we submit. Daniel comes up with an alternative in Daniel 1, and there's some examples in Daniel 3 where the friends cannot submit to worshiping idolatry. And we see some examples in the New Testament, tribulation saints, we're going to see them as well. Anyway, there's a lot of principles in terms of applying here. Two very clear principles seems to be when God has made a very clear statement, clear prohibition, and the government demands that you go against that, and all the examples fit this, that's when you can resist. That's when you look to a higher authority, God Himself. And something that is against a clear and a very fundamental command of God. And you see that in the Acts chapter 4 passage. We didn't have time to look at any of the details there. But these are about the only things that are exceptions in terms of going against government authority. I'm going to skip this as well. I was going to talk a little bit about activism. I think some people are called to it, but you have to have a clear calling and you keep your priorities in order. But some politicians, I think, are called to that, some believing politicians, so I don't think the Bible excludes that, particularly in our culture. And we don't have time to get into 6 and 7, but it talks about the state's financing and the issue of taxes, so we won't get into it. And the last encouragement here is teach children the importance of submitting to authority. Not only will their lives be enhanced, but they will be living according to God's will, and I think God will bless them. And as we get further and further into the government that we are under, and it gets more and more corrupt and further from biblical principles, the challenge of submission is going to get greater and greater. So hopefully these principles and these ideas prepare you to be able to face whatever we have to face in our culture.